Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Web Sleuths Radio. Dr. Weck has just called in. Dr. Weck, good evening, my dear. How are you?
Good evening. Fine. How are you?
Good. I'm going to just put you on hold for just a couple of minutes because I have a few legalese things I need to take care of, and then we will get right to you, Dr. Weck, okay?
Yes, fine.
Thank you very much. Okay, tonight, as you can hear, we have world-famous forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Weck and true crime author Donna Kaufman, along with Web Sleuth's own Cynic. Like I said, I always make it sound like I own him, and I basically do. Cynic is one of our smartest posters on Web Sleuth. Kimster is here as well. She is co-host of Web Sleuth Radio, executive producer. She's administrator at Web Sleuth and the media director as well. Okay. We are going to be talking about Rebecca Zahow tonight. There have been some amazing developments. And if you missed Dr. Cyril Weck's appearance on the Dr. Phil show, we'll get you caught up. And we even have more to tell you because the San Diego Police Department held their own little press conference to try and, I don't know, rebut Dr. Weck, I guess. I'm not quite sure what they were doing, but it's very interesting to say the least. And we'll get you updated on the Rebecca Zahow case, and we'll talk about a few other things as well. And let's remember tonight's panel, we cannot interrupt Dr. Weck or the members of Web Sleuths will hunt us all down and kill us. That's what I've been told, and I truly believe them. Okay, I've had food poisoning all week, everybody, and I don't look good. In fact, I don't look nearly as good as someone Dr. Weck works on in the daytime. So please forgive me. I have not even been on the forum. I am not caught up. So it's going to be basically not even fly by the seat of my pants. It's going to be flying underneath the seat of my pants, if that's even possible. You can go to our chat room if you'd like. Just go to www.blogtalkradio/websleuths and just click on chat there. There's a bunch of people there. Feel free to call in if you have a question at area code 760-825-0933. And Web Sleuths Radio is brought to you by a wonderful, incredible organization called DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. This is a nonprofit organization where their mission is to educate the public on child abuse symptoms, interventions, and preventions. Please visit them at DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. And one more legal thing, just so the lawyers won't have anything to sue us for, the opinions expressed on this show are those of the guests and the host, and I take no responsibility for them, especially my own opinions. Web Sleuths Radio is not the same as WebSleuths.com, which is a completely different corporate entity. Okay, we are ready. The Rebecca Zahow case, one of the most unusual, bizarre cases there is. It was ruled a suicide. She was a young woman found hanging naked in a very unusual, position, if you can call it, hands tied behind her back, and it was ruled a suicide. We're going to start here with that. Let's go with Dr. Wecht, first of all. Dr. Wecht, if you can describe exactly how Rebecca Zahow was found, and then we'll move forward with what you found when you did your second autopsy on her.
Well, in my understanding of the way in which the body was found is as follows. A rope was tied to a bedpost. The rope continued on out through the remainder of that room onto the balcony and continued on down over the ledge, which was about 36 inches high. And about 9 feet down there hanged Rebecca Zahow, found by Adam Shaknai, the brother of the owner of this mansion, boyfriend of Ms. Zahow. Ms. Zahow, as I understand it, was a live-in lady friend of Shaknai. So she was found, as you have already said, hanging. Her hands were bound behind her back in a slipknot arrangement, one which allowed the hands to come in and out, as I understand it, not just a knotted arrangement. The calves were bound by the same kind of rope. There were adhesive marks on the calves, but no adhesive tape was found on or near the body or in the room from which the rope protruded. Then the rope was tied around her neck, the actual hanging component, and overlying the rope was a shirt of Ms. Zahow's wrapped around her neck three times with the remaining portion stuck in her mouth, and her body was completely nude. That is the physical setup. So this woman, 5 feet two, as I recall, maybe 5 feet three, she has managed to tie her hands, tie her calves, tie the rope around her neck, and get up onto the railing 3 feet high, and then drop off from the railing and kill herself. And she did that, as I say, without a stitch of clothing, that shirt encircling the neck, but not covering her in any way. That is the physical setup. And Donna will correct me if I've said anything incorrectly in terms of that physical scenario.
Donna, let's go to you, too. We had Dr. Cyril Weck on the phone, world-famous pathologist, and Donna Kaufman, true crime author. We're talking about the very strange death of Rebecca Zahow in San Diego. Dr. Weck just so graphically described and really painted a picture for us of how Rebecca was found. Donna, give us a little bit, just a brief background for those listening who may not know. There was some very strange things and very sad things going on in that house right before Rebecca was found dead. Why don't you update us a bit on that?
Yes, okay. 2 days before, the boy who was the son of Jonas Shatney, the owner of the house, was visiting his dad. He lived with his mom elsewhere. And he's a six-year-old who fell over the baluster of the inside of the house and had suffered a head injury and was in a medically induced coma at a local hospital. At 12:50, apparently, Rebecca got a phone call to her voicemail that said the boy was not going to be recovering. And perhaps that set into motion whatever happened next with her, because now law enforcement says they don't have that phone call, and I think that's just utterly impossible and impossible to understand. And the boy's mother was at the hospital with Jonah, and when the boy fell, Rebecca, who was 32, had her sister visiting the house. They were the only two people besides the little boy who were in the house. And as the cop who took them to the hospital overheard a conversation between Rebecca and her, I think, 12-year-old little sister, Zena, where she said, "Dina," meaning the mother of the six-year-old, "is going to kill me." Mm. And she was never allowed to go into the hospital because Dina didn't want her there. And mm-hmm. so the cop got enough of that comment that she wrote it into a police report.
That's the first time I've heard of that. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, it probably is. But there was so much that came out of the Dr. Phil show, and that when they started getting into it, they realized, gee, we have enough for two shows. So they made it into two shows. Dr. Wecht was on the second part of the show. There are an awful lot of things that the public hasn't heard yet about this that make you just go, we need some answers. The family doesn't want to accept that this is a suicide. And the cops say, it's a closed case. She committed suicide, and Max was just an accident. Max ended up dying several days later. They just turned off his equipment because he was not survivable.
Wow, that is just tragic.
Oh, I will add one thing, is that on the last night of her life, Rebecca took her little sister to the airport and picked up Jonah's brother, Adam, who apparently works on tugboats in another state, and he was coming to give support to his brother. They went to the hospital where Adam went to see little Max, and the three of them, the brother Adam, Rebecca, and Jonah, all had dinner, And Jonah went back to the hospital and or to where he was staying, which was the Ronald McDonald House near the hospital. And Rebecca and Adam went back to the mansion. Rebecca went into the main house. Adam went into the guest house. This is around 8 p.m. And he said there was no more interconnection between them. And when he woke up at 6 the next morning, he came out to find her body hanging.
Now, let's back up just 1 second here. And Dr. Wex, please correct me if I am wrong about this. The knots that were used for Rebecca's hands, if I'm not mistaken, were some sort of nautical, right? You're into shipping or boating.
Well, I don't know about nautical. They were special knots that enable apparently someone to put their hands in and out. And let me give you a comment from an expert who was on the Dr. Drew show, not Dr. Phil, Dr. Mm-hmm. Drew, who did a show on this. I was on with him. Thursday or Friday? Any event, Dr. Drew stated to his audience that he had with him, he had consulted a rope knot specialist, and that specialist said to Dr. Drew that he did not see how anybody could have done this. Now, that is from an expert, and this statement is being made on national television by a respected presenter, Dr. Drew, who is a board-certified internist, as I understand it, and so on. And let me juxtapose that with something that I have been saying all along, because getting back to something you said earlier, referring to the local officials out there, the sheriff and others poo-pooing this back then, and more recently this past week, trying to say that there's no basis for the criticism and so on. They staged, and I use the word staged deliberately, a presentation, as I understand it, to show that, gee, somebody could do this. I wasn't there. I did not see it, but I've been told about it, and maybe Donna can tell you more about it. But they did this, to which I have said ever since repeatedly, fine, that somebody can do it comes as no great news or surprise. Harry Houdini did this 70 years ago. I want to know where Rebecca Zehow learned to do these kinds of knots. Where did she acquire this special skill? And let me just take one half minute to quickly give you a wonderful, I think, hypothetical analogy to show you the absurdity of what the officials out there presented. Let's just say, in my hypothetical, that Mrs. Jones is found dead at point A, and they believe that her estranged husband, Mr. Jones, murdered her. And Mr. Jones can prove that he was at point B, 1 mile away, just 5 minutes later. Okay? 5 minutes mm-hmm. later, he can prove that he was there. So the authorities, in my hypothetical, wanting to show that Mr. Jones could nevertheless have murdered his wife, they bring in the guy who demonstrates for the news media assembled that he can run the mile in 4 minutes. And therefore, they turn to the news media and say, see, somebody could run the mile in 4 minutes, and therefore Mr. Jones could have been at point A where he murdered his wife. You like that? Is that beautiful? Well, that's what these people did in this case. We got somebody here that can show you how that knot can be done. And to this day, and I've hurled this challenge out, and I'm doing it again tonight, and I'm hoping that some of those people, sycophants, parasites, self-appointed defenders, will be listening to your show, that one of them will have the decency, the integrity, the courage to answer this with all their investigations. What have they come up with to show that Rebecca Zehow could have tied those knots?
They can't come up with anything, Dr.
Yeah, I will add that the police had the ability to get a search warrant and go to that house and do reconstructions with a dummy that was the same size and weight of Rebecca, and they didn't do it. Who did it? Well, Channel 8 did it and did a pretty good job doing it and brought up some problems with the police and law enforcement story. They also failed to do an acoustic reconstruction. There were two witnesses who claimed they heard a female scream around that time, and instead of properly investigating it by doing an acoustic reconstruction, could you hear that from this room? Could you hear it from that room? And you stand out where the bystanders on the sidewalk said they were when they heard it, and you do measurements to see, are these people crazy? Were they distracted by something happening down on the beach? Or could it have been? Because if it is possible that they heard those sounds in a particular room that was close to the sidewalk, well, maybe that's where a crime could have been committed.
And those solid people who have been identified, by the way. These are not some nuts kooks or mere passerbys. They're good, solid people who live around there. And one more point on Donna's reference to the reconstruction. As I understand it, the reconstruction showed when they dropped a 105-pound object representing Rebecca Zahow's body, plummeting it down, that the bedpost moved a lot more than the mere 8 inches, which the police reconstruction claimed occurred in the actual Zahow case. Is that right, Donna?
Yes, exactly. And it's a very interesting thing that they have to explain. I mean,
that's reconstruction.
The police can explain and say, okay, here's why we found this and here's the answer. But they have failed to do that. The family deserves, and the lawyers deserve to have that information, and they haven't gotten it yet.
Well, and I wonder if it's because they don't have the answers, and this is where it's important, Web Sleuths members, to keep the pressure on, because believe me, the media and law enforcement read at Web Sleuths a lot, and if we keep it alive, it will help keep it alive for the family, and that's one of the reasons why we're doing this show tonight. One quick question
you switch over, I want to add one very important thing that the law enforcement officials and the medical examiner have not addressed either, except in the most superficial, meaningless fashion. When I read the autopsy report, I found what the medical examiner had noted. I found something in my examination of the body that he had missed. He had noted it, and I confirmed this in my exhumation autopsy, 4 separate subscapular hemorrhages, 4 separate hemorrhages beneath the scalp. Now, you don't get hemorrhages on the top of your head by hanging down vertically. And the skull, as you know, just feel your head as we talk, has convexities and concavities. You don't have a smooth, flat surface. In order to get 4 separate, discrete hemorrhages, you have to have 4 points of impact, head against something or something striking the head. Not so hard as to fracture the skull or lacerate the scalp, but sufficient to produce a hemorrhage, more than just accidentally bumping your head in the middle of the night when you get up to go to the bathroom in a strange hotel room or something like that. So from whence cometh these 4 hemorrhages? What is the significance of the hemorrhages? Oh, not that they would have caused death, but when you have a subscapular hemorrhage, that connotes the application of some force, and that degree of force sufficient to produce a hemorrhage could be a force big, strong enough to concuss the brain, a cerebral concussion, and it could produce momentary unconsciousness, not prolonged unconsciousness, not any kind of brain damage or bleeding, but enough to cause somebody to be stunned. So when law enforcement says, there's no evidence of a struggle, that's right. If someone has had a cerebral concussion, guess what? They're not going to struggle.
Okay, so you're talking there's four different places on the head that it was hit hard enough to cause a hemorrhage. And it had
four hemorrhages underneath the scalp, yeah.
And it had to be either
hit between the scalp and the skull, but not visible. If you shave her hair, are you going to see that?
No. They're subscalpular. They're underneath the scalp.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from the scalp being pushed up against the calvarium, which is the top of the skull called calvarium. And when you hit it with a blunt, smooth, rounded object that will not lacerate the scalp, or when the head strikes against something that is smooth, rounded, then that pressure, because there's no soft tissue between scalp and bone, I don't care how fat you are, you can press down as we talk now, and you can feel you can't push very hard. And that's why when you get an impact sufficient to produce a hemorrhage, it's because the scalp is lying firmly against the top of the bony skull, and you've got these four separate points of impact, and that has not been answered. The answer they've given is, well, maybe when she went over the balcony, she hit her head. Really? She hit her head four times going over the balcony? You have just told us this remarkable dexterity that this woman has of tying knots and so on, getting herself up on top of the railing with her feet bound and her hands bound and the rope around her neck. But now she's so clumsy that she goes off the balcony and her head is just bumping all over the place. I mean, they have not answered this. They're coming out. They reiterate, we stand by our, we don't have anything new. Of course not anything new. I never thought or said for one moment that I thought that Rebecca Zahow would have been stabbed or shot, or her skull had been fractured, or her ribs had been broken by somebody pouncing and kicking her. Nobody ever thought that, or that there were poisons in her system. No, we're not talking about that. We're talking about this hanging scenario, and they have not addressed these points. They haven't even told us where the adhesive marks come from. Why are there adhesive marks? Maybe somebody thought they'd put their legs together with adhesive tape and it didn't work, and then they used the rope. I mean, I don't know the answer, but there are things that they have to answer, and they were in a rush to judgment. They signed this case out as a suicide so damn fast. Relatively speaking, this case begged out for more investigation. They have not given it, and they stubbornly, with total abjuration, unbelievable reluctance and reticence and intellectual arrogance that comes only from law enforcement, that they are sticking by it. This is it. We don't give a damn what anybody says. And so they're saying, you show us something new. Well, what more? When you answer these questions, then we'll come back to you with something more.
And now Jonah has moved out of the house. They still haven't done appropriate testing to see with a dummy if they could get the same kinds of impact to the top of the head. And so in the absence of that, they should declare this case not a suicide, not a homicide, but under investigation continuing.
Under what we call it, undetermined. Undetermined. Undetermined.
Hang tight. We're talking with Dr. Cyril Wecht about the Rebecca Zahow case, also true crime author Donna Kaufman, and one of our most brilliant posters on web, Foo Cynic, who is very, very deep into this case. And I know he is just chomping at the bit to talk about something. So, Cynic, you have the floor, my dear.
Hey, Tricia, thank you. And Dr. Wecht, thank you for being on the show, and appreciate the opportunity to talk to you again. I'd just like to quickly give you the sort of the full text of what they had to say with regard to the head injuries in the police press conference. This is an exchange between a reporter and John Lucas, the medical examiner. Lucas, in response, says, evidence at the scene supports, and the binding supports, the notion that she leaned over the balcony, shifted her weight over, and went over in that fashion, and you can imagine that she'd be going with her head down or at least sideways. It's my thought that one of those impacts on the head was probably from the edge of the balcony as she went over. There were four impacts. One of them was 2 inches by 1 inch. That's the one that I think probably came from going over the balcony. The three others were smaller than a nickel. Not only did they not represent enough force to cause unconsciousness, they may not have even given her a headache. These were small injuries. I don't know exactly how they happened, but they were minor and inconsequential. The reporter then asked, could the 2x1 inch injury have caused unconsciousness? Lucas, I don't know. Reporter, you are aware that the balcony has no lip that sticks out, right? There is nothing to hit on the way down because there is no lip that sticks out beyond the railing. Lucas, I still think she could have hit the railing. There are spaces between the railing. I think she could have gotten her head on the edge. It may not stick out, but there's still space for her to get her head in there. Reporter, do you think it's unlikely that after she went down and became vertical, maybe a swing a little bit, it would be unlikely for it hit her head at that point? Lucas, well, I think it's a possibility. And then he later adds, one other option was when she was cut down, there may have been possibly an impact in that way. It could have bled a little bit, even post-mortem. You can get a little bleeding after death. That's referring to when Adam Schack and I cut Rebecca down after he found her. Do you have any comments?
Well,
I bet Dr. Weck has a lot of comments.
well, I think the statement speaks for itself, you know. Could have that, and the reporter, whoever he was, he had some good questions. Nothing was protruding, and so on. And the hemorrhages were not quite as small as he said, by the way. And the larger one is a significant hemorrhage. And when he says not enough to produce, first of all, he's making a statement in here. You know, I've been very nice to this guy, and I'm not challenging his competency. On this statement, let me say something. He can no more say that that hemorrhage would not have produced a concussion or unconsciousness of a fleeting moment than I can say that it did. The point is that you can't say that it did, but you cannot say that it did not. And for him to make this statement is absolutely incorrect, because we don't go around cutting people's scalps open when they're still alive to see how much hemorrhage there is. You don't get a hemorrhage beneath your scalp from something of a glancing, superficial nature. And that is a statement that he has no business making. And for him then to talk about, well, she bounced her head here and she hit her head there, that is absolutely incorrect. And like Donna said before, where's the reconstruction? Then show us how this head that would have bounced in this fashion. Did he reconstruct this? Did the police do it? No, they haven't.
And that's just it. Go ahead, Sinek. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I agree with you 100%, Dr. Wex. As a matter of fact, I did a post on this earlier today. Actually, if you sort of look at the dimensions of Rebecca, look at the dimensions of the railing, if she had bent over, the very top of her head would be approximately 7 or 8 inches from the roughly from the base of the balcony. So the top of her head only has to travel about 7 or 8 inches. In order for her to get an impact, the 2x1 near the top and back of her head on the right side, she would have to have been completely rotated, and somehow, other than the force of gravity pulling her downward, there would have to have been some other force to basically bop her head back into that railing. I just cannot possibly see how that could happen.
Thank you very much. Thank you, sir, very much for having. Work that through. I appreciate that. That's a wonderful analysis, which I shall keep in mind. Thank you.
I'm telling you, Dr. Weck, this is one of our most brilliant posters, and he's mine now. He's not going anywhere. He's my sidekick. He will be with me at all times, whether he likes it or not.
He's not a slave. You're not hiding him in the cellar. If you are, I hope you're feeding him well and taking good care of him.
I'm feeding him well, yeah. And water occasionally when he's been good, but that's about it. Okay.
Go
ahead, Sinek.
Okay, just I've been dying to ask you, Dr. Wecht, several questions since you've now had an opportunity to actually do the autopsy rather than simply read a report. One thing that's troubled me. After I actually did some posts, which I did visual aids. I tried to interpret the autopsy report, and using Photoshop, I tried to mark the injuries where they were. And one thing that struck me as I was going through doing those visuals is that the autopsy report suggests that there were a great many abrasions to Rebecca Zahal's back. And I also noticed that she only has one abrasion on each of the posterior of her arms. If she has that many abrasions on her back, how did her arms escape abrasions? I mean, her arms would be, the back of her arms would be the first point of contact, you know, with any surface, which suggests that, you know, that her arms were not indeed tied behind her back. Do you have any comments there? Or am I correct?
Well, that's a good point. And the reason that I cannot respond with specificity to your very pointed question is because I haven't had the benefit of a full pictorial layout of that setup there, exactly the surface onto which her body fell, and so on. We supposedly, Adam Shack and I cut her down standing on a three-legged table with a cell phone in one hand, cutting her down the other hand, and then I don't know exactly how the body fell. What was the physical relationship, the distance between any bushes, thorns, weeds, or so on, as the body fell down, this remaining whatever it was, 19 inches or something like that. I don't know, and that's why I can't answer. But I think you make a good point, and that gets back to the whole business of reconstructing, so that you could see a body would fall, and you know, so what kinds of abrasions would you get?
But I realize that, you know, we don't know some details here, but just in general, like let's say you had your hands tied behind your back and I dragged you along a surface there, the first point of contact is going to be the back of your arms.
You're right. Your arms are going to be between, the arms tied behind your back are going to be between the surface and your back, right? And you make a good point that the arms should sustain more damage than the back.
Exactly, and on the autopsy report,
yeah,
it says on the medial right elbow, there's a 1/8 inch faint pale red abrasion, and then on the posterior mid-left forearm, there's a 1/8 inch red abrasion. And those are the only two injuries that I see on the entire autopsy report to the arms, and I find that just incredible and impossible.
No, it's a very good point, a very good point. How could there be so many on the back and only one on each arm of a very limited nature? If the arms are tied behind the back and she falls down, then obviously with her arms still tied, he cut the rope that was around her neck hanging from up above. He did not cut at that point the rope binding her hands, so therefore the hands and the arms would have remained pulled back behind her back. You're quite right.
And then
Dr.
on the
Wick, go ahead, Cynic, I'm sorry, go right ahead.
No problem. And then on the flip side of the body, almost literally, on the front, on the torso, again, there was no injuries. And if, the police keep on saying, Lucas keeps on saying that, you know, she leaned over, went forward again, her torso going over, you know, over that iron railing, again, should have produced some abrasions. And on the torso, and it seems...
Excellent point,
enough,
excellent point.
You know,
there's no
abrasions there. And also her face. So, you know, Lucas talks about injuries, you know, potentially to the top of her head, which I find impossible because I can't see that she would have rotated in that short space of time. However, mm-hmm. if she had leaned over and the first point of contact is probably going to be her nose, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. Again, I would suspect some serious injuries to the nose and to the front of the face.
Yes.
Other than three small abrasions to her forehead, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind the top of her head at the end of subthaleal hemorrhaging.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what about the front of the face?
Yeah. You're right. Excellent point. You've got the nose, no matter how small a nose it is, it's protruding, isn't it? It's not as flat as your forehead and your chin. It protrudes out somewhat. And if you got her going over in the fashion that they are depicting, they are conjecturing in order to try to explain the subscapular hemorrhages, then you make an excellent point. The face would have had the contact first, before the scalp, and certainly the nose and the cheekbones protruding slightly too. A very, very good point. I thank you. I think you have done a great job in blowing Dr. Lucas's explanation right out of the water.
And that's what we do on Web Sleuths, and this is just an incredible example with Cynic. I do have a question from our chat room, Dr. Weck. Do you know if there were any photos before the Emmy's arrival at the scene showing liver mortis in her hands and feet?
To my knowledge, no photos were taken before. Your question is before the police arrived? Not
well,
that
I
know of.
Okay. I mean, I was just reading it directly from the from the chat room. So what have
you? Yeah, but let me address that because there has been conjecture that the liver mortis that was on her back indicated that she was on the ground when she was when she died, but that is secondary liver mortis having been placed there. If there was a photo of her as she was hanging, we would expect to see the liver mortis in her feet and legs because that's where the blood goes. But even after you're dead, you can your blood pools into that, and gravity does its thing. Isn't that right, Dr. Wex?
Well, here you go. Your liver mortis begins to develop an hour and a half, 2 hours usually after death. It does not become fixed until about 8 hours later on. If the body's position is moved, before 8 hours, then you may not have some. You may not have lividity as it was initially being formed because. It did not have a chance to become fixed. If the body is moved after about 8 hours, then you'll have the primary liver mortis pattern followed by the second dairy liver mortis pattern, assuming that the body is placed in a different position. The point that Donna makes is a good one, that liver mortis, which I found between the ribs posteriorly, is certainly a liver mortis that developed as the body was lying on the ground. Do we know, Donna, what is the estimated amount of time, minimum to maximum, that she would have been hanging from that balcony? What do we know about that?
The last known thing that she did was at 12:50 when she retrieved a voicemail message.
12:50 a.m., by the way. You mean after midnight? After midnight, a.m.
Right. She was cut down around by Adam around 6:45 in the morning. So the death happened at some point in between those two times.
And that voicemail, this is a big mystery. We're talking with Dr. Cyril Weck, world-famous forensic pathologist, as well as Donna Kaufman, the incredible true crime author. We have Kimster, my co-host, and Cynic, a brilliant poster on Web Sleuths. We're talking about the very strange case and death of Rebecca Zahow. And that voicemail, we assume, I mean, and I don't know how we know this. I have a feeling there's some inside information going on here. But supposedly that was from the hospital telling Rebecca that the young boy that was in her care that had the accident was not going to pull through. That is what we assume was in the voicemail. Donna, expound a little bit about that. Why can't we get this voicemail? I mean, it's there somewhere, isn't it?
Well, that's in contention. The police didn't even bother checking for it, from what I understand, until they realized that this was something that the family and Ann Bremner and Marty Rodoy, who are the attorneys, started complaining about. And then they said it's too late to retrieve it. They did say at some point, somebody said it was from Adam, and it was to, maybe they asked him about this, but to give her the news that they were going to be having to look at the child as dying, and it was just a matter of, you know, when they turned off his life support equipment. But I believe that there may well be a chance to retrieve that message, and if law enforcement didn't use all the power of their awesome responsibility and job, and this is every forensic technician's dream, is to be able to pull that message off of that machine, off that equipment once again, and certainly they should go balls out to do that.
Balls to the walls. That's a great motto in this case. That's exactly what they should do, and I think the police are putting a lot on that voicemail by suggesting that voicemail drove her to suicide. Well, if they feel that way, then they should do whatever they can to find if they can get that voicemail back. It's there somewhere. Whether it can be retrieved or not, I don't know. Let's go to Kimster, our co-host here, as we talk to Dr. Cyril Weck, Donna Kaufman, about the strange death of Rebecca Zahow. Kimster, we do have some chat room questions on Web Sleuths Radio. Why don't you go ahead, my dear?
Yes, I have one from Glory B, and she wants to know, Dr. Weck, did you see signs of strangulation which would have been present if the cause of death was hanging, but if you tied the sleeves of a shirt around your neck three times, that would also cause strangulation?
Well, it's a good question. When you have a hanging scenario like this and you have damage internally to the neck structures, then it's sometimes not possible to differentiate pre-hanging strangulation followed by a staged hanging. Let me say that there was sufficient damage, substantial damage, to the neck, the hyoid bone, which is a small, delicate U-shaped bone just beneath our mandible, beneath the jawbone, the bottom of the U-shaped bone out toward the front and the open portion pointing back toward the rear of your neck. That bone was broken, and there were hemorrhages in the muscles and so on. Those are the kinds of injuries that you can get from a forcible manual strangulation. They cannot be differentiated. And I'm glad that question was asked, because I'll tell you why. I had made the comment that there was a total absence of any injury posteriorly. The cervical vertebrae, which are the first seven vertebrae in our spinal column, beginning at the base of the skull, the first one being called the atlas, and after Atlas, who held the world on his shoulders, the occiput, the skull, rests upon that first cervical vertebra, and then you come on down. No damage, either by way of fracture or dislocation. Also, no damage to the delicate muscles and ligaments and tendons that lie on the front of and the back of and to the sides of the vertebral column. No damage at all. None found by Dr. Lucas and none found by me. And then they say, well, you don't always have to have damage in an executioner's type of hanging. I'll agree that you don't always have to have it. But isn't this interesting? You have all that damage anteriorly, fracture of the hyoid bone, hemorrhages and so on, all that force in the front, and not one single drop of blood, not one slight 1 millimeter tear of any soft tissues in the rear. So isn't that interesting too? So I'm not saying she was strangled, but I want to make it clear that there is no way, in my opinion, that it can be stated that they can rule out that she was strangled first and then hanged. That cannot be ruled out. That is a definite possibility. I'm not saying that it occurred, but I want to make it clear, and I'm going to repeat it for emphasis. It cannot be ruled out.
Dr. Weck, you had the opportunity to do a second autopsy on Rebecca Zahow, and I know how much the family so appreciates how much you have worked for them and continue to work for them. On this autopsy, we've talked about how you found the small head injury.
Well, Lucas had found them. No, I want to make it clear. I didn't find something
that's right.
That wasn't reported.
Right.
No. I want to make it clear.
You found it.
That
yeah.
These were described by Lucas in the first autopsy. Yeah.
You found them, and I'm going to ask you maybe to go out on a limb here. What type of instrument could make that type of injury to the head? I mean, would it just be a hammer? Could it be a floor? Could it be a board?
I don't think it would be a hammer. I think it could be anything from a fist to look around at your home, probably not there, maybe even at your office. Look anything on your desk that is smooth and round and reasonably firm. Doesn't have to be metal, doesn't have to be hardest wood in the world, could even be plastic. Just anything that is smooth and that is not going to penetrate or perforate the scalp in any way, such as to produce a laceration or even an abrasion. You could think of a thousand things.
I was going to say, I'm looking around, I can see a million different things.
Let me interject something, if I may. One of the things that makes this so significant is the color of these injuries, that being bright red. If it were that she banged her head on her car door a few days before, four times, that would not be as significant a color. Isn't that correct?
No, that's right,
Donna. The color matters.
No, that's, thank you. They are acute. They occurred just shortly before her death. Oh, one more point. Lucas said that it could have happened when she was cut down. No, I'm going to criticize my colleague. When the body drops down and it's been hanging there for 6 hours or so, no, you're not going to get, there's not going to be bleeding after 6 hours. In the minutes after death, yes, but 6 hours later, and the kind of fall that would have occurred, that short distance with the body falling down, no. And how does it fall down? On the top of its head. Once again, it's hanging vertically, and he cuts it. And so how do we get a hemorrhage on top of the skull? No, top of the skull, underneath the skull. No, they're not coming up with a plausible explanation. They really are not, and I'm a little professionally, intellectually offended that they would have the audacity, the temerity to put something out there that is pure poppycock.
Kim, go ahead, Cynic. We have Cynic, one of our posters on Web Sleuths, who's followed the Rebecca Zahow case, and we're talking with Dr. Cyril Wecht and Donna Kaufman. Go ahead, Cynic.
Thanks, Trisha. Sorry for jumping on you there.
No problem. You go for it.
You're absolutely right, Dr. Wecht, and that is such a long shot. And also, you know, if she was cut down, and that's how, you know, allegedly, according to law enforcement, it happened, you know, was she cut down? Did her head hit four times, you know, in four separate locations? I mean, you know, that's one of the more preposterous explanations that they've given, I think. But I did want to go back just a bit with respect to the settling of blood or the lividity. Now, I completely acknowledge that the blood, you know, would have settled, you know, in the back, you know, as is suggested. But many posters, and myself included, I seriously cannot see how the blood would have left the lower legs and the feet. Her legs were propped up on about a, you know, 45-degree angle, you know, sort of bent and a little bit to the side. And that's how she was found, at least in the helicopter shots that we have. There's just, you know, it's not like her legs were propped up and the blood would then flow back. From those lower legs, how in the world is that blood going to get, you know, just by gravity, which is, of course, always pulling it down toward the ground, how is it going to end up away from those legs? And if there was no lividity...
Well, no, I agree. There would have been some residual settling of blood in the distal calves, the feet, and the feet. I agree with you. I haven't seen clear photos of those legs and the bottoms of the feet. Are they available? Do they show absence of lividity? Do they show no blood formed in there? No discoloration?
Yeah, there's no mention of it made. The only mention in the autopsy report is, you know, strictly to the back, and I guess there's also some suggestion that in the upper front of the chest there was also some lividity. But those are the only comments mentioned about lividity of the entire autopsy report. And I just found it
raises a body hanging there like that. Donna says, you know, we're talking something close to 6 hours, something around there, and so on. That's right. It's not all going to diffuse. No, you make a very, very good point. And there should have been some because, you know, the distal calves in a delicate woman like this are slender, and the blood that forms there is not going to just perfuse back on into the upper part of the body just because she is now lying on the ground.
And with respect to the what you just said a moment ago as well, with in terms of the neck injuries, It's good to hear you say that there was absolutely nothing found there, like nothing in terms of damage to the ligaments or any other.
Posteriorly, absolutely nothing.
Yes, posteriorly, yeah. Because I think the in the news conference or the press conference, it was the point was made that I think they were specifically talking about Hangman's fractures, but okay, perhaps not in all cases, but, you know, in terms of a long drop hanging, are you going to get a, you know, a cervical fracture? But certainly, you know, given that distance, there would, you'd think especially there would be at least some damage to the ligaments. Correct?
That's right. You got a quite a distance there. Quite a distance, 9 feet. And right, exactly. And I thank you for emphasizing that point. Do not allow any, and I'm saying this to you guys and to myself and everybody else, do not allow them to focus solely upon the absence of fractures. I've made it clear from the beginning. I'm not talking about only a cervical vertebral fracture or a dislocation. I'm also talking about muscles and ligaments and tendons, and there is no pulling, no tearing, no distortion, no disruption, no bleeding at all posteriorly. And I don't believe that that would happen, especially in the presence of all those severe injuries in the front of the neck. How could it be that the back of the neck sustains zero trauma?
Dr. Weck, wait. Oh, go ahead, Cynic. I'm sorry.
You can shut me down if you want to.
I do have a caller. I'll tell you what, Cynic, if you could throw one more question out, and then we're going to go to a caller we have, okay?
You got it. You also mentioned the injuries to the anterior of her neck, the front of her neck. I mentioned this last time I had a chance to talk to you. The cricoid fracture. You've obviously seen the injuries, and you've noted that the rope, the furrow from the rope made as it encircled her neck, was considerably higher than that. How is it that there would be the cricoid fracture, which is considerably lower than that furrow line? How is that made? And there's no indication of any sort of abrasions in terms of, say, for example, if the rope was at around that point and slipped up, I would expect there to be sort of abrasion marks that would indicate the slide of that rope. There's none of that there, at least not according to the Lucas autopsy, and yet the cricoid is fractured. Do you find that unusual, or is that?
Well, no, you're quite right. And for the listeners, the cricoid cartilage is the first cartilaginous ring of the trachea, located just beneath the thyroid cartilage, your Adam's apple. So feel your Adam's apple, and just below that at the base is the first cartilaginous ring, this concentric ring that forms the wall of the trachea, the windpipe, and it's called the cricoid cartilage. It has its own name, and it's interesting, you're quite right. So you have, again, evidence of that much force, even extending downward to the cricoid cartilage from the point higher up where the hyoid bone is located, all of that damage and everything. And your point about, sure, then the rope, if it's down there producing hemorrhage to the cricoid cartilage, it should slide up. Now, they may say, well, it did not necessarily have to slide up, that it could have been from the disruption of the neck, pulling down with the body weight slamming down after that 9-foot drop. That's fine. Then that takes me back to my comment posteriorly. If you have that much force that extends all the way down to the cricoid cartilage from the hyoid bone underneath the mandible anteriorly with the rope placed that high, how come we don't have any evidence of force posteriorly, you see? So it is, they dig a hole deeper and deeper for themselves with their comments.
Thank you, Dr. Weck. We do have a caller. A Web Sleuth member is on the line. And Web Sleuth member, go ahead. You have a question for Dr. Cyril Weck or Donna Kaufman on Web Sleuth Radio. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my question. First of all, I would like to thank Dr. Weck for coming here and for speaking out on behalf of Rebecca and her family and for seeking justice for her. I'm very grateful to you for doing so. Here's my question. Based upon Dr. Lucas's autopsy report that I have read time and time again since I've been following this case, in regard to the torso injuries, in the autopsy report, the injuries that are noted to the abdomen are as follows. On the lateral right lower quadrant of the abdomen, there is a 1/4 inch pale red abrasion. Just inferior to that is a discontinuous faint 1 by 1/8 inch thin linear abrasion on the lower, on the left lower quadrant of the abdomen along the curvature of the left iliac spine. There is a 3/8 by 1/4 inch red abrasion. What I want to point out regarding these abdominal abrasions that were noted in the autopsy report is that if Rebecca was reported to have, according to the San Diego County Sheriff's Department, to have gone over a 36-inch iron railing during the course of this so-called suicide hanging. And I have looked very closely at these photographs. I've looked at close-up images of the iron railing, and I've seen that this iron railing is not a smooth surface. This is a very rough, and in many areas of this iron railing, there are very jagged, ragged edges. My question is, and I know that a medical examiner's report is typically based upon a wide variety of information. So my question is, how is it possible, how is it absolutely possible that the sheriff's department is claiming that she hurled herself over this 36-inch railing without sustaining serious injury to her abdominal area and hip area?
Well, I of course I can't answer that for them. You make an excellent point. I haven't seen these pictures and studied them in the fashion that you have, and I thank you for pointing this out. And my response would be that if the surface is indeed that rough and ragged, and they say that she dragged herself up and stretched out over that in some fashion, I would agree with you. There should be more abrasions. I wouldn't go so far as to say serious injuries, but certainly more extensive abrasions. Abrasions being scratch marks. For the listeners who aren't sure what that term means, as opposed to lacerations or contusions, bruises. So I would expect there to be more abrasions than those two minute superficial abrasions on the right side and one on the left side.
Thank you very much.
Do you have a follow-up question?
Caller, can I just make a point? Because I know we're running out of time here.
Donna Kaufman, go ahead.
One of the things that, you know, Dr. Wecht is so good at using his medical skill, which rivals anybody in the world, really. I mean, he is the top guy. And also being a lawyer, it's putting all these little things together to build a case. And our current book, From Crime Scene to Courtroom, does that on a number of major cases. And that's what we do. That's what it's about, is giving the reader a chance to see how these cases are built.
Exactly. And I can certainly see this becoming a topic of one of your amazing books, because something needs to be done about this, the Rebecca Zahow case. It's just, it's maddening. When I sit and listen to you, Dr. Wecht, my blood pressure goes up 100 points. I can't imagine how the family feels. Kimster, let's go to you. We have a question from Ann in Texas. And Kimster, what is that question from the chat room?
Well, that question is actually Ann in Texas and Too Curious asked the same one. They want to know why Ann Bremner doesn't take this forward to the authorities with an official request to reinvestigate.
Ann is the family attorney. Maybe,
right.
Donna, maybe you have an answer to that question.
Yeah, well, I believe that that's exactly what she's doing. She's just building her case first and is planning to do that. One option she has is to go to the attorney general. If the prosecutor in San Diego and the law enforcement in San Diego is reticent to take on this investigation and do it, even though, like I say, the house is empty now, there's nothing to stop them from doing the proper evaluations that they need to with their criminalists, there is another option to go to an attorney general and see if that person will look into this case.
Let me add something. I think as we wrap it up here, I'm going to have to go. But let me just say this: I note with and I'm smiling as I say it that although it's a different county, still it's the state of California. That in Los Angeles, they're talking about reopening a 30-year-old case involving Natalie Wood based upon sheer nonsense, as far as I'm aware. And down to the south in San Diego, given what we've been talking about, and no matter how you look at it, there's some serious points that have to be addressed. And down there, they are sticking their head in the sand and burying their feet in the firm mud and saying, no, you're not going to drag us into anything further. And the case remains closed and it's satisfied. So maybe what we got to do is move the case up to Los Angeles, where they seem to have a little more open mind.
There you go.
Yeah.
Dr. Weck, I do appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you very much.
Dr. Weck, I'm going to send a link to the San Diego Sheriff's Department to listen to this show. Is there one final thing you would like to say, perhaps just to maybe get their attention before we leave?
Other than to express my appreciation to you for having us and to getting into this discussion. And the only final thing I want to say is happy Thanksgiving to all of your listeners and all the members and devotees of WebSleuth. Thank you very much, Trisha. And Ben, I hope you're feeling better.
Thank you, Dr. Weck. I really appreciate it. Donna, can you stay on for just a few moments while we wrap things up?
Sure.
I know Dr. Weck had to go. Sinnott, can you stay on for just a few moments?
Certainly.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much, folks. Nice chatting with all of you. Happy Thanksgiving. Take care.
You too, Doctor. Thank you so much. You're so nice to spend so much time with us
on a
Sunday night.
It's my pleasure. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Donna, right now, basically, the case is closed, according to the San Diego Sheriff's Department, and that, like you mentioned, Ann Bremner can take it to the Attorney General. You've been in this, I don't know if the word business is the right word, but you've been in these types of cases for many, many years. How likely is it that the Attorney General is going to step in and say, okay, San Diego, you messed this up, and I'm stepping in to take over? Isn't that just really hard to do?
It's very hard to do. And if you remember, Jonah Shacknai wrote a letter early on and said, hey, AG, why don't you look into the case? And she denied that at that point. But, you know, with all the time, it's a matter of what can you prove that is new. And I think that Dr. Weck's take on some of this is new. Also, if you can show that investigators did not do due diligence, that shows that there's bias potential, and there are a number of issues there that certainly should be heard out. And I would hope that the Sheriff Gore takes this seriously and answers the questions that he needs to answer.
Absolutely.
You know, I hope we don't have to wait 30 years for them to reopen this case as they have with Natalie Wood.
Exactly. And I just want to ask you a quick question about Natalie Wood, and then we're going to wrap it up for the night. But first, I want to go to Sinnott. We were just talking to Dr. Cyril Weck about the Rebecca Zahow case. Dr. Weck was so gracious to give us a full hour. And Donna Kaufman, his co-writer, is with us, co-author.
Yeah, you know what?
I
have to jump off now. I'm getting another call.
you guys go ahead.
On and let me know what happens.
I will. Thanks, Donna. Thanks for calling.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, Sinnott, it's just you and me. And, boy, that's kind of scary. But, Sinnott, what are your final thoughts on this case?
Well, I'm sure this is not going to, you know, come as news to, you know, the followers on the websites with respect to the Zahow case, but it is very interesting, some very interesting developments with respect to the case in the last couple of days, most notably with respect to the pornography aspect.
Tell us about that.
Yes, on the day prior to, I'm assuming this was on the day prior to Rebecca being found In other words, in the time period in which Adam Shachnai, the brother of Jonah, was in town, somebody had looked at pornography on the computers in the home, and the specific type of pornography that was being viewed was bondage pornography, and also allegedly Asian bondage pornography. So, you know, given the fact that Adam Shachnai didn't actually
bound,
this guy, you have to keep in mind, he did not actually pass a lie detector test, as I believe was alluded to, you know, in some prior shows as well. It was officially found to be inconclusive. It was the way the police phrased it is that the examiner, the polygrapher, felt that he was telling the truth, but officially on his report, it was inconclusive. And it was interesting also during that lie detector examination, it came out apparently that he was viewing pornography on his iPhone just before he walked out of the mansion guest house and found somehow hanging. So this is, I don't know, part of his alibi. I'm not sure, you know, what it's meant to be. But, you know, you put all these pieces together, you know, along with the very sketchy, you know, details found in the autopsy. Yeah, it still just every day amazes me that, you know, this case is has been ruled to be, you know, conclusively a suicide rather than at the very least undetermined. It's just amazing.
Well, and I think a lot of it has to do with money. The people involved have money. Rebecca's family does not have anywhere near that type of money. And that's where the only thing that works is public pressure. So with somebody as high profile as Dr. Cyril Weck and Donna Kaufman at his side, along with attorney Ann Bremner, and then you add Web Sleuth into the mix, I think if we put it all together, we can keep the pressure on the San Diego Sheriff's Department to do something. We won't forget, and I know the members won't forget. Cynic, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I hope you'll join us again soon, my dear.
I will.
Take care. Okay, everybody, that wraps it up tonight for Web Sleuth Radio, and we'll be back next week. In fact, next week we will have an update on baby Lisa Irwin. I apologize. We were going to have one tonight, but I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't get to it, so I do apologize for that. Next week, though, we have private investigator Ron Rugen. He's going to be on for at least an hour, maybe longer, with us. He is right there in dead center in that whole case. He has been there from day one. He has interviewed most of the case players. He has the inside scoop like nobody I have ever heard inside of a case before. Very well-respected man. Ron Rugen, he will be with us next week, in addition to many other guests, which I have yet to contact, but I will, and they will say yes because I said so. Web Sleuth Radio, it is brought to you by the one... Oh, wait a minute. Kimster, are you there?
Hello?
Kimster, I'm sorry. Before we wrap it up, I need you quickly. Don't everybody leave. Stay. Tell us what you have been working on as far as the unidentified forum. Oh, my gosh, I can't believe I almost forgot that. Go. This is so good.
Well, I'll tell you what, it started with our brand new serial killer forum, and we've had a lot of interest in that forum, I'll tell you. It's been pretty amazing. I had no idea there were that many unsolved serial killer cases out there. It is scary, you guys, so be sure to go in there and especially check out your areas, you know, and see what's going on. But maybe if you read some of these threads, you might have some clues and you can help figure out, put some of these clues together, figure out maybe a serial killer has moved to another area and you can see where some of the same modus operandi is going on somewhere else. But I was in the Killing Fields forum, sub-forum, which is in the serial killer forum, which is also now the Killing Field plus I-5 Mystery Murders 2. We've kind of combined them both. And there were a couple of unidentifieds that Mr. TT had looked at one of them, and it looked like a match. We thought we might have a match.
Right.
What happened was I had never done this before, so I went ahead and contacted law enforcement. and talk to them, and come to find out they did a DNA submission, and so it wasn't a match. But there was some kind of a, and you know, I'm not quite sure if I'm supposed to share, so I'm not going to tell you everything. I'm sorry, but there was some kind of a thing with the family. I don't want to concern the family, but they wanted to take DNA from another family member, actually, and try to match that in two. So, we might have a match still, but it doesn't look very likely.
There was enough there to go to law enforcement, and it very well could have been a match. And I'm telling you, people, if you go to the serial killer forum, if you go to the unidentified forum, and just look around and read, you could be the one that makes a difference. That's the point, isn't it, Kimster? That we can really just make a difference.
Yes, and I wanted to tell you guys, I want to share this because I found out by, you know, kind of chatting with some of the moderators, actually, that it used to be I was always interested in the unidentified forum, but I would go in there and it just seemed so overwhelming. And so I wouldn't actually go in there and work on any of the cases. So, but now, because of Mr. TT, what he found, I went, you know what, if he can do it, and if Carl can do it, and so many of our other members have, you know, had some matches, if they can do it, I can try. But where do you begin? So if you go in the forum and you're going, wow, I'm totally overwhelmed, let me tell you this little trick that Bessie, one of our moderators, told me. If you go up to the toolbar, the little blue toolbar, there's a place that says thread / and another thread, I think it says starter or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you push on just the word thread, all of the unidentifieds come out in state order. So
that's perfect.
So what I thought was, well, you know, I'm real familiar with Oregon because that's the state I live in, and I thought, you know what, I'll just start working Oregon. And that's what I've been doing. And I'll tell you what, it not only am I familiarizing myself with unidentifieds, but I'm also familiarizing myself with a lot of the missing persons. And I've got a flyer right here I printed off the computer. In Jackson County, Oregon alone, there are 12 missing persons.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
Because you want to kind of familiarize yourself with what they look like. So when you're going to NamUs and when you go in the unidentified forum, that'll be a major place you go a lot because that's where they list all the unidentifieds. But, you know, you can go in and you can go, oh, that photo, that reconstructive, you know, drawing that they've done on there kind of looks like that person, you know, in Jackson County. You can do that. And just start small. Start with an area if you want, or just start somewhere. But that was how I did it, and maybe that will work for you. I know some of you might live in New York or California. You might just want to start with your own county. I know there's going to be a lot more missing persons than probably my whole state. But just, you know,
exactly.
Just start. And I'll tell you what, I was on the forum the other night for hours getting familiar with this, and my heart is going out to our members that have been there, you know, searching for these matches for months and months and hours and hours. They need our help. They need our help. And my new theme for that forum right now is come and help us give these people their name back so they can go home.
That is great, Kimster. And you do, I don't know if everybody knows this, but Kimster works nonstop on Web Sleuths. It's all volunteer, and you do so much behind the scenes. So I want to publicly thank you for all you do, Kimster. You're a wonderful friend to so many people all over the world. Thank you for everything. And thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. It has been a wonderful show. Web Sleuths Radio is brought to you by the great people at DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. This is a nonprofit organization where their mission is to educate the public on child abuse symptoms, interventions, and preventions. I invite you to visit them at dreamcatchersforabusedchildren.com. Web Sleuths Radio, where we discuss current events and true crime, always using common sense. We'll see you next week on Web Sleuths Radio. Bye-bye.